The secret war disrupted the patrilineage that formed the foundation of Hmong cultural identity and its clans. Nearly 25% of Hmong men and boys, or an estimated 30,000 to 40,000 Hmong soldiers, were killed in action, and up to 3,000 named missing in action.
That's writer Lisa Lee Herrick, reading from her recent essay, Eating 30 in Fresno, Finding Home at Hmong New Year, in the online publication Boom California. Herrick talks with FM89's news director Alice Daniel about why so many Hmong refugees came to Fresno after the CIA's secret war in Laos under the guidance of their leader, General Vang Pao, and why decades later, the city's Hmong New Year is still a global draw.
Your article in Boom California pays homage to the resilience of the Hmong people, their ability to sustain this sense of identity through clan and kinship ties, despite being scattered around the world. And it sounds like from your writing that the Hmong New Year Festival in Fresno not only exemplifies, but is also sort of the center of that resourcefulness. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So for a lot of Hmong Americans living in Fresno, California, a lot of the grassroots political movements, a lot of the social services, a lot of the religious community here, and in fact, I would say pretty much all Hmong Americans who have come here by way of allegiance and working with General Vang Pao. And Fresno became his sort of his home base in a sense, because there were so many military veterans groups that were started here that were founded and staffed by his family, still continue to be. And a lot of them made their residence here. So it was just really an easy way to access him, to find leadership. In a way, he was a liaison between the Hmong community and the federal government, especially for those of us who came here to this country completely by random. It was a lottery system. So many Hmong refugees, when they first came to America, had never really heard anyone speak English. Many of us didn't know how to read. Those of us who were educated and literate were very few and far in between. But for the most part, the majority of refugees, Hmong refugees from Laos, were farmers with a very, very, very minimal education. And Fresno was just, it was a great fit because Fresno is a very agricultural community, but it's also extremely urban. A lot of Hmong could still farm. But the Fresno Fairgrounds was really crucial because having that space available to recreate a sort of temporary marketplace and venue where all Hmong could gather and be enclosed and see each other and just really interact the way that it happened in Laos was a great, great benefit to the community here.
And your own family moved from Merced to Fresno in 1992 and, of course, every year went to the Hmong New Year. It didn't always sit that well with you as a teenager, right? You felt like you didn't fit in all the time. You were taller. Your skin was darker from summer harvest work. You found ways to rebel, including dyeing your hair red or wearing harsh eyeliner or a jean jacket scrawled with anarchy signs. Could you read a bit from your piece, the part that describes the sort of tension between you and your more traditional mother?
Sure, absolutely. When I was a teenager, the last thing I wanted to do during my winter break from high school was to dress up for Hmong New Year in my mother's heavy, musty, hand-embroidered hemp clothing from her trousseau. I was a milk-fed American girl who ate cheeseburgers and fries nearly every weekday for lunch, so at 16, I was already wider and thicker than my mother, who was petite and fine-boned at 5'4" and shrinking. Dressing up for the Hmong New Year was a multi-step process that can only be described as attempting to put on all of your formal wear at once while pinning the money from your wallet to every square inch of fabric available, a must for good Hmong daughters to prove to potential suitors and mother-in-laws at Hmong New Year that you were wife material. First, there was the black velvet jacket worn over a white, collared, button-down shirt, which was then wrapped around the waist using two thin cords. The seams of my hand-stitched jacket bulged and groaned against my widening back with each passing year, and I felt the pins and needles in my fingertips as the peacock blue cuffs coiled tighter and tighter around my meaty forearms. "Why are your breasts so big?" my mother sighed, smacking my chest. "Are you wearing a bra or not?" "Mom!" I whined. Next came the heavy, pleated hemp skirt. My paternal grandmother's was dyed black with white trim and cross-stitched with bright pink, orange, green, and turquoise threads, symbolizing the Hmong's journey over valleys and mountains to reach Laos, because she was a member of the Green Hmong tribe. My mother's skirt was plain and white, because she was a member of the White Hmong tribe, and she wrapped this around my hips with two long sashes. The skirt flared open in front like a hospital gown worn backwards, and my mother sucked at her teeth. "Ayah, your butt's too big for Hmong clothes," she said. "If I had known that you girls would grow as big as cows in America, I would have bought more fabric." "What? Why are you making that ugly face?"
"It's a fantastic description. Thank you." The contemporary Hmong New Year is very different from past traditional celebrations in Laos or China. It sounds like it's evolved in the past from marking the end of the harvest season to clan leaders now drawing on their military skills or expertise to Americanize the festival. Can you talk a little bit more about the differences sort of pre and post 1975 in terms of the Hmong New Year?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Hmong New Year, first of all, is kind of a misnomer because in our community, we call it Nuo Beikyo, which means to eat the 30, as in 30 days. Coming from our agricultural roots, you spend the majority of the year farming, sowing seeds, tending your crops, fattening up your pigs and your cows, feeding your chickens. So at the end of the year, when the harvest is good and a cow has been slaughtered, that's the one time of the year that everyone basically pigs out for 30 days. Everyone eats as much as they want. It's also a great excuse. It's like a huge dinner party for the village. It's also a good excuse to invite other people from other villages to say, come on over, let's celebrate, let's eat together. With that format, it was more about family reunions. It was more about being able to relax for once. Whereas now, you'll see that the Hmong New Year is, I wouldn't quite say it's quite commercialized yet, but it's definitely adapted to contemporary Hmong American tastes. So the Hmong New Year now is more of a proper festival. There are lots of programs and activities. There are songs and dances and concerts, the Hmong Beauty Pageant. Also, vendors pay money to appear there. And especially this year, I saw a great diversity of vendors. We had a Korean American church. We had, Chicanx vendors sending churros, pickles, and burritos. We had a lot of entrepreneurs setting up shop for websites, for clothing lines, and fusion cuisines. So it's really becoming a true marketplace, which is really different from its original beginnings. It's very humble beginnings.
And the cultural centerpiece remains the Miss Hmong Beauty Queen. It was a program originally introduced at a military base in 1968 to boost Hmong soldiers' morale.
I believe so. According to the research I've read and a lot of secondhand knowledge from my parents, a lot of them do recall the Hmong Beauty Pageant initially was started to really just raise the morale of a lot of soldiers who had recently lost the Battle of Phupathi. It was a huge loss because that was where the radio towers were. So I think in order to kind of lift people's spirits up, they had a Hmong Beauty Pageant where the winner would basically be sort of the ambassador to the Hmong community. These days, though, I think the Hmong Beauty Pageants are a little bit more modern in that they've really taken a lot of their programming and choreography from, contemporary American pageants.
Hmm.
I think that in recent years, as you have second and third and fourth generation Hmong Americans coming up, I wouldn't quite call it criticism, but there are people raising their hands saying, is this still relevant? When I was a judge in 2017, it was one of the first years that the organizing groups had splintered into three groups. And so the Hmong cultural group decided to do the pageant this year because they won the bid for the Fresno Fairgrounds. And I think that their flexibility and their openness to changing the format really reflects a generational shift. And if it is a contemporary, program, and not necessarily an essential part of Hmong culture, I feel that that generational shift is okay.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the fact that you were a judge, and that was in 2017. Why don't you read us the section in your article where you explain your reaction to being asked to be a judge?
As a staunch feminist and reformed hippie punk artist with infrequently neon hair and frequently loud opinions, I sat stoically in my chair in front of the main stage at the inaugural Hmong Cultural New Year celebration. I wondered if I was now part of a new vanguard of second and third generation cultural brokers, signifying that the Hmong American community was ready for new leadership. Did this mean that I was no longer the black sheep of the family? Was my appointment as a Miss Hmong USA beauty pageant queen purely ironic? What did I really know about what an ideal Hmong woman was supposed to look, act, and sound like? I had eschewed my mother's nightly bandal lessons, preferring instead to run wild with the neighborhood boys in the woods and listen to grandfather's war stories. While the other Hmong girls in my parents' church had married young and helped on the family farm or lived at home while taking classes at community college, I had enrolled at the furthest school possible and only returned on holidays to debate politics, justice reform, public policy, and queer rights with my uncles over their beers. My hair changed with my moods from pink to red to purple and blue, and I left rainbow smears all over my mother's white pillows and towels that refused to wash out. I still enjoy arm wrestling with my male cousins. Did my appointment to influence the results of this year's beauty pageant reflect a sea change in gender norms for Hmong American women, or could I wag the dog in some minute capacity?
And what you found is that you could, in fact, wag the dog a little bit, right? You saw that the Hmong New Year festivities had changed quite a bit from when you last attended. Can you leave us with a few thoughts? How did you sort of square your past rebellion with your kind of current perspective?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that the judging was very unbiased because each judge was not allowed to discuss or meet the pageant contestants beforehand. I tried to be very thoughtful and purposeful with my notes and also stating that, for example, some of the contestants had talked about college and careers and wanting to be independent while still respecting their parents and their grandparents and their origin stories. So in my notes, I tried my best to really say, I applaud you for that. It's a burden, but it's a good burden. And I think that my small contributions there really help steer that community a little bit more. As far as the actual winners go, I feel that whoever wins, it's a great honor to win. They're essentially being honored by their community. But as the beauty pageant does change, as dance choreographies become international, as clan names and clan affiliations become less important, I think that just shows that we are truly becoming Americans in a sense that we are diverse within our own communities and we are able to, really address those gaps. There's enough space for conversation now.
Well, Lisa Lee Herrick, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Alice.